From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Well, the 100 Black Men is part of a national organization founded in 1963 in New York City. Essentially, Black men in the community decided that it was time for us to come together. You know, there are obviously fraternal organizations, there are church organizations and so on. But where do we bring together the best of the best to support and mentor our youth? And that's always been a backbone of what 100 Black Men do. Malcolm Gardner was our first president there was a 100 Black Men chapter that was in Austin for a while, and it kind of fizzled out. Mm-hmm. We came back. Brother Malcolm led us that first year. And this year, Dr. Gregory Vincent, Vice President of Diversity and Community Engagement, and also a colleague of mine in the College of Education, is now the president. And so we've really taken on this issue of being visible, being prominent, and serving the community full on. In some of my work, John has talked about the challenges that African Americans face in Austin.
Dr. Richard J. Reddick, Associate Professor and Coordinator, University and College Student Personnel Administration, College of Education, the University of Texas at Austin. With the recent events in Ferguson, Missouri, Professor Reddick, a member of the 100 Black Men of Austin, Texas, felt it was necessary for him to express his views in an op-ed piece. Professor Reddick stated, and we quote, "According to USA Today, nearly twice a week in this country, a white police officer killed an African-American person from 2005 to 2012. Nearly 9% of the whites killed during this period were under the age of 21, compared to 18% of African-Americans. Mike Brown's tragic fate has a depressing sense of familiarity to it. The unimaginable pain of a family and community loss, the necessary press reaction, and the fading of a young man's memories have become tragically routine. There is an endemic threat to African-American males in America when it comes to interaction with law enforcement." I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the 100 Black Men of Austin, Texas, with Dr. Richard J. Reddick, In Black America.
We really feel that we want to be a asset to the community and bring to bear our talents, our experiences, our knowledge to help this next generation of young men. I have two kids. Carl is 6. Catherine is 4. And, you know, every time I hear a situation about a Black youth or youth of color coming to an untimely end because of a misunderstanding or something that was completely unavoidable, I think about them. And I'm like, not every kid is blessed to have both parents or blessed to have the resources that my kids do. You know, what am I doing to help the kids that don't have those things? And I think the collective of 100 Black men in the city of Austin, we all have that same belief. We had a meeting over at the Gus Garcia Young Men's Academy. Sterling Magruder is the principal there. And, you know, just to see those young men and know that those young men are looking for role models, looking for mentorship, and we're going to provide it for them is so exciting. I mean, I wouldn't be where I am today without mentoring. So I know that's a critically important thing. And that's really a cornerstone of what we do with 100 Black Men.
The mission of the 100 Black Men of Austin, Texas is to improve the quality of life and enhance educational and economic opportunities for all African Americans. 100 Black Men was founded as an organization in New York City in 1963. The national organization, 100 Black Men of America Incorporated, began with 9 chapters in 1986 as a national alliance of leading African American men of business, public affairs, and government with a mission to improve the quality of life for African American youth. Today, there are 110 chapters worldwide. With that said, the Austin chapter of the 100 Black Men are ready to step up their efforts. The tragic events in Ferguson, Missouri, are not simply the concerns of Mike Brown family or even the Black community. It is a concern that affects all people who believe in human rights. Dr. Richard J. Reddick is a member of the 100 Black Men of Austin. Also, he is a professor in the College of Education at the University of Texas at Austin. As a father of two, he perceived our youth as our most valuable resource and treasure. Our commitment to serve these promising young people and help them reach their unlimited potential is steadfast.
I really enjoyed ROTC. I was certain I would be a military person. I was certain I was going that direction. And I think for me, I would come back on, I think Wednesdays was a uniform day. Come back to campus wearing an ROTC uniform. The clientele at Travis High School wasn't having that, so I had to deal with a lot of abuse. But, you know, I kind of dealt with it. But I remember distinctly when I was at Johnston, my principal, Irma Novoa, came in the office one day, or came in off the bus. She says, "You look so handsome in your uniform." So I was just, okay, I like this. And I got to wear like the color guard uniform with the ascot and the cords. And then the funny thing is that a lot of my classmates joined the military. Okay. And they were like, "Oh, you look crazy in that outfit, man." But I'm like, you know, here you are in the military now. But it was a great experience. And I actually ended up leaving ROTC my senior year because I wanted to be at Johnston full time. I had really sort of embraced that school and I wanted to be there all the time.
We were talking before the interview and we were talking about you attending Johnson. Mm-hmm. And Johnson has been having academic problems for the last decade or so. Obviously, you must have achieved a good education at Johnson.
Yeah, and the thing about it, John, is I think Johnston has a long legacy since 1960 of producing leaders and academically strong students, even though we may come from communities that are not looked at as being college-going and so forth. So I went to Johnston, and like most students who moved to Johnston after AISD was declared unitary and busing was over, we're hesitant. I went to Travis High School, I went to Reagan High School, and I was scared to go to Johnston. I was like, well, that's a rough school. But the teachers there were amazing. I just had the most amazing, most caring teachers, Tony Castillo, Carol Hovland, Pat Tenbrookie, Irma Novoa, I mentioned, you know, all these folks I had who were teaching me who really were like, you guys are from East Austin, you're from Southeast Austin, but you can be somebody. And every single year at Johnson when I was there, there were students going to Yale, to Bard, and you know, just going to great schools, and that never got out. In fact, one of the most important stories I think about Johnston is the year I graduated, 1990, UT offered a scholarship called the Texas Achievement Honors Award. Mm-hmm. It was a five-year scholarship for students of color, high-achieving students of color. The year I graduated, I believe we had four Texas Achievement Honors Award scholarships handed out. We were the only school in the state of Texas to have that many. So the tradition of Johnston being an academically strong school, and this is before the Liberal Arts Academy was there. It existed, but I think, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, right? I think people are much more interested in hearing about, you know, the sad stories versus the stories of kids who were really working hard and getting an excellent education at Johnston. So it was very painful for me to be at graduate school at Boston, actually up there with another Johnston graduate at Harvard University and kind of seeing the decline of that school. That was really painful to watch from a distance. And so we have those memories and, you know, the Johnson's alums I talk to now, we still talk about the great teachers we had, how invested they were, how they didn't take an excuse being poor, being Latino, being Black. It didn't matter. You were going to achieve because, you know, this is what we do here at this school.
Tell us about that at Harvard experience.
Yeah, so the Harvard experience is interesting because I remember when I was a senior in high school, a teacher said to me, you know, you're going to go to UT and you've got this great scholarship deal. Have you thought about going to schools elsewhere? I'm like, no, I got a girlfriend here. I married that girlfriend, so I think it worked out okay. But, you know, I just didn't see myself going to a place like I'm a first generation college student. I knew what Harvard was, but it just seemed too distant to me. And I think UT was a great place for me to go. However, I remember having a conversation with a classmate of mine walking in front of the tower. And she said, well, what are you going to do when you finish, you know, college? I'm like, I'm going to teach. I went and teach for America for 2 years in Houston. And she's like, well, what about after that? I'm like, I'll go to grad school, I guess. I didn't know what grad school was. Mm-hmm. Where are you going to go? I guess I go to Harvard. And she said, you can't just say you're going to go to Harvard. You know, Harvard's hard to get into. I'm like, it is? And it's made sense. So to make another story connection, when I was a junior here at UT, I was on the Wheel of Fortune College Week team. And they filmed that show up in Boston. So I traveled to Boston on Wheel of Fortune's dime and got to sort of see Harvard and like, oh, it's gorgeous up here. So I always had them back in my mind. And so I ordered a view book and I said to myself, okay, it's in Boston, it's cold, it's white. Do I want to go up there? I said, well, look, if I open this view book up and I see Black faces, that will let me know this is a place I can go to. I opened the book up. I saw a picture of Professor Charles Vert Willie. He was a professor of urban education. And I'm like, well, he's there. And I opened another picture up and a guy named Roland Hentz, director of admission, he's there. And those two gentlemen were pivotal in my experience. Dr. Willie and I have collaborated on three volumes and he's a mentor to me in in just amazing ways. And I think about that experience, meeting somebody at Harvard University who's from Oak Cliff, Dallas,
okay,
who was a classmate of Dr. Martin Luther King at Morehouse, you know, who was a member of my fraternity. All these things we had in common, and we just connected. And he was just a caring, supportive mentor to me in ways I just didn't expect to find at a Harvard. I thought Harvard people would be elitist, and, you know, here's a guy from Oak Cliff talking to a guy from Austin and, you know, getting him ready for the rigors of graduate education. So I went back for my doctorate in 2001, and Dr. Willie called me back. He said, I'm working on a book project. I want you to work with me. I applied, went up there. We were up there for 6 years. And I really consider that experience to be really critical in shaping my experience. We, my fellow classmates and I really got involved with the idea of bringing opportunities for scholars of color, alumni of our university, to come back and share their research, especially the folks who had worked in fields that were not traditional academic fields, so people working in communities and so forth. So we formed and founded a alumni of color conference, which has been around for 14 years now. And I make a habit of trying to go up there every year with students and let them see what Harvard's all about. And they go up there and like, people up here are cool, and they're doing important work that matters in communities of color. This is amazing. I'm like, yeah, this is what I got to do for 6 years. So it's an amazing place. And I feel really fortunate that I had that experience. But certainly it's great to be back here in Austin and at UT Austin, my alma mater. So
what was it about education that sparked your interest?
So, you know, a lot of people who are educators come from families of educators. And so for me, my grandfather, Carl Bryan, was Jamaican, and my grandfather was involved in education and politics in Jamaica, and that kind of trickled down throughout my family. So we, when I was a kid, my grandfather worked for Encyclopedia Britannica, and we always had encyclopedias in the house, always. And my parents would never tell me answers to questions. They would tell me, go look in those expensive encyclopedias we have on the desk. The other thing I think is living in the United Kingdom, and in the UK in the 1970s, we had three channels. And during the daytime, what they would air was television for schools and the Open University. So I'm sitting here watching TV, and I'm learning about the Second World War and how tires work and all these other things. And my mom has a story where she says, she came home one day and I was talking about pneumatic tires. I was like 4 years old. She's like, what is that about? You know? So I've always been attracted to the educational process. And even when I was a kid, I used to mentor or tutor kids who were in grades below me and so forth. And because I had moved to so many different schools, I think school had become a very important part of my life. And I was always blessed with having very caring teachers. So I always knew I wanted to be in education in some way. I thought the Air Force would be a sort of way to do something that was related to that in some way. But I really realized, my gosh, everything I'm doing has to do with working with young people, has to do with learning. And I always tell my students, I said, listen, if I had the talent, I'd be singing a song or playing a music instrument or telling good jokes, but I can't do that. So I'll be in front of a classroom and do it. And if I do those jobs halfway decently, I'm funny as a professor. So it's something I've always gravitated towards. And I feel lucky that I've been doing it all my life. I think I spent a few months working at Motorola after high school, but I pretty much have spent my entire life working in education, either K-12 education, higher education, graduate education. It's where I live. It's what I do. It's what I do. It's who I am.
I understand that you taught elementary and middle school in Houston. There are very few African-American males at the elementary school level. Mm-hmm. What type of enjoyment did you get from that experience?
John, I think it initially was frustration because when I first got to the school, I realized that we had a principal, a number of coaches, and a custodial staff who were males in the elementary school.
Okay.
I was the only pedagogue. I was the only teacher. Right. And so initially, when I got there, I kind of started to role model myself after the coaches. So I'd wear, like, you know, sweats. And the students were kind of like, well, you're not a coach. You know, why are you doing that? And then the other thing, of course, was the students would call me Miss. I'm like, they're trying to be funny. But I realized they had never had a male teacher before. So it was an experience for both the students and myself. But what I really enjoyed about it was I had this group of middle school guys, the school, E.O. Smith Educational Center in Fifth Ward, Houston, is a 1-8 school. And so we had a common area in the middle, and we had middle school kids on the side and elementary school kids on the other side. And I would be there at lunchtime. The kids would come up and would start talking to me. And the conversations were hilarious. They're like, "Mr. Reddick, why do you listen to white music? You listen to white music, don't you?" And I said, "Well, wait a minute. White music. So rock and roll, right? Yeah, yeah, that's white music. You know, we like to listen to Bone Thugs and Harmony." I'm like, "Well, wait a minute. Let's talk about rock and roll. Do you know who Billy Eckstein is? Do you know who Chuck Berry is?" And I played them that stuff. And they were like, "Oh my gosh, that's a black person playing that?" I'm like, "Yeah, rock and roll is our music." And they'd be like, "What?" And we go up there and we talk about things like prom. I remember I had these boys come to me and say, "Mr. Reddick, I'm in eighth grade. I'm going to go to prom this year." I'm like, "No, no, you're going to an eighth grade dance. There's no prom in eighth grade." "Well, I'm going to graduate." "No, you're getting promoted to ninth grade. You don't graduate till you get to 12th grade." And so these conversations we had, and I realized at first I was like, these boys are just here to clown me and just give me, mm-hmm. you know, grief and pressure. But I realized they didn't probably have opportunities to talk to another male, older male, about these kinds of things. So whether it was about, you know, how you treat women and, you know, how do you sort of plan for your future and so forth. And it wasn't always that deep, but sometimes I'd have these conversations. I had one student, Sam, and Sam was really interested in the arts. And I encouraged him to apply for the high school in performing and visual arts. And he got in. And just that whole process was just really exciting to me to say that, you know, I might be saying something to these kids that will sink. And that's one thing about education I think is really important. It's rarely a aha moment when somebody tells you, you are going to do this excellent thing and it happens. You plant seeds and those mm-hmm. seeds germinate. And sometimes it's right after you say it, or it's a year after you say it, or it's 10 years after you say it. But I can still remember my experience, you know, third grade teacher, my first grade teacher, mm-hmm. my high school teachers, my mentors here at UT telling me things and then, oh, now I get it. So I think that was an amazing experience. And I had wonderful support. Eunice Alexander was a teacher at E.O. Smith who was just incredible to me. She just was so nurturing and so caring. And you know, the first year of teaching is difficult for everybody.
Right.
And I failed more than I succeeded, I'm pretty sure. But I just think that having somebody who says, you know, you're doing a great job and you're doing a wonderful job and it's important you're doing the job you're doing. And I saw it too, because in my community where I taught, it was so important to make sure I spent days in the community. So I'd go to school, you know, 6 a.m., whatever, start school. School's over at 3. Mm-hmm. I don't go home till 6 because I'm going to kids' houses,
okay.
talking to parents, talking to big mamas, talking to everybody about what's going on. That was actually advantageous to me because I realized I can actually get some of these students who are, you know, discipline issues.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to big mama. Big mama, work it out. You know, we get that problem solved real quick. But you also go home when you tell stories about the student doing well. You know, I remember I had a student named Ricardo. Ricardo he gave me a lot of grief. And I was at his house every day. And so finally one day, probably October, had a decent day. I said, "Well, go to your house." He's like, "Mr. Reddick, not again." I was like, "No, man, you did a good job today in school." And he's like, "Really?" So we went to the house, went up there, and his sister Rocio was the translator. His mom spoke Spanish only. And I was telling her, you know, "I'm here because he actually did a good job today at school." Mama starts crying. Mm-hmm. I start crying. Ricardo starts crying. And that's the kind of stuff that you say, "My goodness, I'm making an impact here." So I look at those days very fondly. Teaching was the hardest job I've ever had, elementary school. Harder than grad school, harder than Harvard, harder than tenure at UT Austin. But it's a job I loved, and that's why I'm so invested in education. I always said I would never abandon that part of my career path. I was always going to have a connection to young folks in schools and working with teachers and so forth. So that's where it comes from. And it's, like I said, it's what I do. I don't know if I could do anything else besides this.
I understand. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Dr. Richard J. Reddick, Associate Professor and Coordinator of College and University Student Personnel Administration here at the University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Reddick, tell us about the 100 Black Men of Austin.
Yeah, well, the 100 Black Men is part of a national organization founded in 1963 in New York City. Essentially, Black men in the community decided there was time for us to come together. You know, there are obviously fraternal organizations, there are church organizations and so on. But where do we bring together the best of the best to support and mentor our youth? And that's always been a backbone of what 100 Black Men do. And Malcolm Gardner was our first president who, there was a 100 Black Men chapter that was in Austin for a while and it kind of fizzled out. Mm-hmm. We came back, Brother Malcolm led us that first year. And this year, Dr. Gregory Vincent, Vice President of Diversity and Community Engagement and also a colleague of mine in the College of Education, is now the president. And so we've really taken on this issue of being visible, being prominent, and serving the community full on. In some of my work, John has talked about the challenges that African Americans face in Austin. And, you know, I think that's something that the 100 Black Men is addressing. You know, we have a lot of intellectual capital, political capital, economic capital in the city. How do we bring it together to benefit the youth in this community? And obviously what's happened in Ferguson has been troubling for many of us because, you know, most of the Black men I know, we've all had experiences interacting with law enforcement that has not been positive. Even skinny, nerdy Richard Reddick, you know, as a 14-year-old had to deal with police, you know, harassing him and so forth. So, you know, we really feel that we want to be a asset to the community and bring to bear our talents, our experiences, our knowledge to help this next generation of young men. I have two kids. Carl is 6. Catherine is 4. And, you know, every time I hear a situation about a Black youth or youth of color coming to an untimely end because of a misunderstanding or something that was completely unavoidable, I think about them. And I'm like, not every kid is blessed to have both parents or blessed to have the resources that my kids do. You know, what am I doing to help the kids that don't have those things? And I think the collective of 100 Black men in the city of Austin, we all have that same belief. We just spent, we had a meeting over at the Gus Garcia Young Men's Academy. Sterling Magruder is the principal there. And, you know, just to see those young men and know that those young men are looking for role models, looking for mentorship, and we're going to provide it for them is so exciting. I mean, I wouldn't be where I am today without mentoring. So I know that's a critically important thing. And that's really a cornerstone of what we do with 100 Black Men.
How do you all interact with the African American Youth Harvest Foundation?
Well, both Dr. Vincent and I are on the board of the Youth Harvest Foundation. And the Youth Harvest Foundation, you know, Michael Lofton is a community fixture here. And right. Michael saw this. And Michael and I always talk about this. We're both Austin guys. You know, we can talk about sort of the changes the city has seen. And, you know, we understand the importance of bringing, you know, support to our community. So many of our kids don't always get to see the successful folks who are doing things in the city. So, you know, the Youth Harvest Foundation right now, we're just initiating our work with them. But essentially, the plan is to work and mentor with those youth. And we're bringing in mentors who come from a variety of different backgrounds. So some folks in education, some folks in the business realm. Some folks who are from Austin originally or from Texas, folks from out of state. It's just exciting because I think a lot of times one of the benefits of bringing a group like 100 Black Men to the Youth Harvest Foundation is to show them that, you know, there are Black people from Ohio or New York and life is like this there. And they're like, okay, that's a little different, but, you know, you made it. You know, how do I make it? And, you know, the Youth Harvest Foundation is doing incredible things in the community. And I'm just so excited to see these young people, you know, show their talents. You know, the robotics they're doing, you know, we do a lot of things with computers over there. And, you know, just seeing our organization having affiliation with, you know, a group that's already established and doing good things is really exciting. It's really bringing together a lot of the pieces because if you're from Austin, you know, there's good stuff happening in this community. There's good stuff happening with these folks. We're bringing these all together. And I think what we really want to do with the 100 Black Men is sort of be that go-to organization. When you know, we've got a youth that needs assistance. We got somebody who needs, you know, a mentor. Hopefully we can be that organization to help with that.
You wrote an op-ed piece. Why was it important for you to articulate that thought?
You know, John, like I said earlier, I think for so many of us, that what happened to Mike Brown is so chilling because with the advent of social media, these cases that happened before that were isolated in this community, because everybody knows a brother who had a run-in with the police, maybe got beaten, maybe got shot, maybe got killed. We all know about these stories. And the stories become more egregious. You know, at one point, you know, it's a story about a youth and you don't know if he had a weapon on him. And then it's a story about an unarmed youth being shot down. And the fear. I have a colleague and once we were talking about this recently and said, you know, having a black male child is both the most exciting day of your life and also the most frightening day of your life, because you know you're going to spend the rest of your life worried about what's going to happen to this young man. And it was heartbreaking. And, you know, the first line of that editorial talked about the fact that, you know, we just found it, we were chagrined by this because it happened once again. And even though it's not a law enforcement issue per se, but Jordan Davis, Trayvon Martin, Renisha McBride, all these youth who have, you know, been gunned down, you know, and it just came to a point where I felt, and Greg Vincent and Mark Gooden and Kevin Coakley, my colleagues, you know, came together and said, you know, man, this is something we need to talk about. We need to do it quickly. And Greg Vincent is a very motivating person. He's like, you know, write something. Let's get this done. And so I went home that afternoon, that evening, really, and just kind of poured out my thoughts about what's happening. The brothers I mentioned before had helped me sort of shape the thoughts, and then we got it, you know, in there. So I just think it's really important for people to understand. There's often a discourse about where are the black men, you know, where, you know, and that's presumptive, you know, that when you see a youth and something happens that somehow there was something deficient in their life experience. That's really, I mean, it's often not the case. And we felt the need to say, you know, our youth need to be looked at as assets and the future versus being problems. And that how you frame how you look at a young man, a young black man, I think is really critical, because a lot of folks in the community don't look at them as kids who do kid stuff and need to be, you know, brought aside and mentored and supported versus treated as threats. And there's some really disturbing social science research that's looking at the fact that Latino and African-American boys are often assumed to be much older than they actually are.
Right.
And, you know, it's, to me, it's incomprehensible to think that, you know, in an affluent community, in a predominantly white community, that an 18-year-old child will be shot without a weapon. It's just, it's incomprehensible to me. And I think one thing that this has kind of showed me is that even this time we have President Obama and we have all these sort of indicators that people want to sort of pull out and say we're post-racial, in a lot of ways, the gulf between the perception of reality for African Americans and for white Americans might be greater than it's ever been.
Right.
It may be. It just frightens me. So I really wanted to put pen to paper and really express that perspective and really let people know that 100 Black Men is here to do this work, and also that it's work we all need to do.
Dr. Richard J. Reddick, professor in the College of Education, the University of Texas at Austin. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at jhanson@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.